Question. So, what I plan to do today is to complete the discussion on planning and planning graphs, and hopefully by about, I guess what, 2:30, and then we'll shift gears and go into Markov decision processes, which is the next topic that I would start discussing. And after Markov decision processes, we'll talk about adversarial search. In fact, there's a nice segue from MDPs into adversarial search. Adversarial search is essentially game trees and the chess and all that fun stuff. And then after that, we'll come back to knowledge representation, so propositional logic and Bayesian propositional logic or probabilistic propositional logic and so on. Okay? So actually for the planning, in some sense, I went over pretty much everything that I wanted to go last time. All I'm going to try and do is repeat a couple of things just so that it sticks in your mind. So if you have any questions, you should ask me, stop me, we'll deal with them. Okay, so the first thing is we kind of kept talking in the background about interactions between sub-goals. And here is something that you should keep in mind. I don't know why this is flipping back and forth, but so when you have, you know, it's useful to know these terminologies for sub-goals. A bunch of sub-goals are considered independent if doing progress on one of them does not in any way affect the progress on the other. Okay? And a bunch of sub-goals, and when they are independent, if I tell you that I have a plan for making the G1 true, which is 4 steps long, and I have another independent goal, G2, and I have a plan for making G2 true, that's 5 steps long, and if you want to do G1 and G2 together, you right away know that there is a plan of 9 steps long for doing G1 and G2 together, because they're independent. Okay? And now, if in fact, so in fact there are three, the issue then is the relation between the cost, the length of the plans for supporting individual goals and the length of the plan for supporting all the goals together. In the case of independent sub-goals, if you have L1 is the length for supporting, length of the plan for supporting G1, L2 is the length for supporting G2, etc., LN is the length for supporting GN, and if they're all independent, then the length of the plan for supporting all of them together is essentially L1 plus L2 plus LN. That's it. Now, if these goals, if it's anything other than this, then you say they have interactions. That's the way to think about them. Now, if these goals only have positive interactions, that means in trying to make one goal true, you can only help the other goal along. Then what happens is if L1 is the plan for G1 and L2 is the length of the plan for G2, then doing both would be cheaper than doing each of them separately. So there are positive interactions. Okay? So in that case, the length of the plan for supporting all the goals is less than the sum of the lengths of the plan for supporting each of them. Okay? That's the positive interactions case. If you have negative interactions, then it's the opposite. So if I have goal 1, I can do it in length 1, in a plan with length 1. Goal 2, I can do it with a plan with length 2. Doing both of them could be much harder than doing either one of them separately. Okay? In fact, it could be as hard as, so this is actually, so in that case, you say there is negative interaction. And how bad can it be? These could be finite and this could be infinite. So for example, I can make, in any simple world, in something like a blocks world, I can have a plan for putting A on B. Okay? I can have a plan for putting B on A, both of which are finite length. But I have no plan for putting A on B and B on A at the same time. So the length of the plan for doing A on B and B on A together is infinite. Okay? So negative interactions essentially make the length of the plan be longer than the individual goals. Yes. What do you mean?
As in, they only apply this way. So if the subgoals are independent, then you can infer that. But if you have, for example, for the second one, if you know that the length of the whole plan is less than the sum together,
mm-hmm.
you can't automatically infer that there are only positive interactions.
Okay, so now that's a good question. So in this is like a nice abstract model to have in mind. In normal problems, when you are solving a problem, oftentimes you'd like to talk about the independence of the top level goals. And then when you're trying to achieve this goal, upfront it might look like they can actually be done separately. But then when you sub-goal, so when you're trying to achieve this goal, you put in an action, you have sub-goals. Okay? So we are actually interested in talking about the interactions between all the goals. Okay? And in a normal problem, it's neither the case that all the sub-goals are independent, nor is it the case that all of them are positively interacting, nor is it the case that all of them are negatively interacting. Some subset are positively interacting, some subset are negatively interacting, some subset are independent. Okay? Now, having said that, anybody who tries to estimate the cost of L1 to N, and the cost of all the N goals by adding up the length, is making the assumption of independence. So the world may or may not be independent. World may or may not be full of independent sub-goals, but I'll just act as if everything is independent. Okay? And the H sum heuristic that we looked at in the planning graph essentially is making the independence assumption. Okay? And anybody who assumes that things will mostly positively interact so if you look at the H level heuristic, which looks for the first level at which all the goals are appearing together, in essence, that's making the positive interactions assumption. That means everything is positively interacting. And so if there's a 5-length plan for G1 and a 4-length plan for G2, then really the total plan would just be 5-length, because the 4 for G2 would be just a subset of the 5 for G1. Okay? And finally, if you start taking mutual exclusions into account, you are essentially taking into consideration the negative interactions between subgoals. So you can think of improving the heuristics in terms of how much interactions you take into account. Now, you can also consider the following issue. If you, for example, made the independence assumption, okay, if you made the independence assumption, and in fact, in reality, the goals have positive interactions, then your heuristic would be admissible or inadmissible. You made the independence assumption. The goals actually have positive interaction. So the heuristic estimate would be admissible or inadmissible? Inadmissible. Okay? Similarly, you made the independence assumption and the goals have negative interaction. The heuristic would be ill-informed. It would actually be too far from the real value. Okay? So by not taking negative interactions into account, you wind up giving up on informedness. Okay? And by not taking positive interactions into account, you'd wind up sacrificing admissibility. Okay? And that is if I'm sitting with the independence heuristic. Now I'm situating myself at the H level heuristic, which essentially assumes everything is only positive interactions. Then from the point of view of positive interaction heuristic, if the goals are actually independent, the positive interaction heuristic would be ill-informed. Okay? In fact, that was the picture that I was showing you last time, and I actually made a better picture somewhere. There you go. So here is a nice example to keep in mind where there's a different version of this slide that I showed last time, but this is a nicer version. Here are two examples, and all this slide is saying is H level and H sum, neither of them dominate each other. Okay? Here is a scenario where H sum is way better than H level, because H level would say P1 to P100 can be satisfied by one step plan, but that step has 100 actions. Here is a situation where H sum would say that these things would require a 100-step plan, but each level would say one. Now, if you consider H relax, which just considers a plan which actually supports all the goals, then then you can see that in both cases, H relax would get the right number. Do you see that? Because in H relax, what do? You start with all the goals, and for each of the goals, you pick an action. And for each of the actions that you pick their preconditions, put them in the graph, and go on. In this simple graph, as soon as you pick, there is only one choice, first of all, so you pick whatever action is there, and then they don't have any preconditions. So really, this entire subgraph is the relaxed plan. And if you add up all the actions, there are 100 actions there. Whereas in this particular case, right, you pick again these P1 to P100, and if you are actually trying to support each of these goals, B star would be the only solution, only choice that you have anyway. Okay, so H relax can be potentially better than H level as well as H sum, and so that's why it's worth understanding it. Now, what is missing in all these three, H level, H relax, H sum, is negative interaction. Okay, and the mutual exclusion will take the negative interaction into account. And you know, here is an example of what the mutual exclusions would look like for our. I mean, I already went through one example in the class. Here is another example where you have mutual exclusion on the blocks world problem, and I only showed some of the mutual exclusions in red. Okay. And then you know, if you have mutual exclusions in front of you, and if you're looking for level heuristics. If you're looking for the level heuristic, okay, then what would you do? You would essentially look for the first level where the set of goals that you're looking for is present such that no subset of them have been marked to be mutually exclusive. Okay? And you should remember this, I mean, the rules for propagating mutexes, you can actually forget that one rule, these three, so in terms of mutual exclusion propagation, the most important thing to know is the entire mutual exclusion starts from static interferences between actions. Okay? Two actions are considered statically interfering if one guy has preconditions that wind up opposing the preconditions or effects of the other guy, and vice versa. Okay? You start by marking those actions as mutually exclusive, and then you use these propagation rules to propagate the mutual exclusions forward, from actions to the next proposition level, from the next proposition level to the actions, and so on. Now, when you go from actions to the proposition level, you would consider a pair of propositions to be mutually exclusive if every way of supporting one proposition is mutually exclusive with every way of supporting the other proposition. Okay? So if there are m ways here, for one a proposition P has m incoming links, proposition Q has n incoming links, you are talking about m times n pairs. If one of those pairs is not marked mutually exclusive, then P and Q are not marked mutually exclusive. It's very important to understand that. So if there's one way in which you can do this and this together, then they are not mutually exclusive. Okay? And then going from propositions to the action, how does having mutual exclusions listed on the proposition help in propagating it to the action? I may or may not have mentioned it last time, but let me mention it again. So here is the situation. So I have P and Q in some level, and they have been marked mutually exclusive. Okay? I have an action A1 and an action A2. A requires only P. And A1 requires only P, A2 requires only Q. They are essentially mutually exclusive now. Even though they are not statically interfering, okay, even though this guy's precondition, so it could well be that this guy's precondition is P and effect is M, and this guy's precondition is Q, effect is N. Okay? So they are not statically interfering. And yet, because P and Q are already marked to be mutually exclusive at this level, these two actions will become mutually exclusive. And furthermore, in fact, it has nothing to do with A1 having just one precondition and A2 having one, just one precondition. A1 can have 100 preconditions, P1 up to P100. And A2 can have 100 preconditions, Q1 up to Q100. All it is needed to make two actions mutually exclusive is one of one guy's preconditions is mutually exclusive with one of the other guy's preconditions. It's almost the opposite of where when we went to the proposition. In the proposition's case, two propositions are mutually exclusive only if every way of getting here is mutually exclusive with every way of getting here. That's a very strict condition. Here, essentially, I'm saying because So in that case, that makes sense because a proposition is valid as long as there is some way of supporting it. So supports for propositions are disjunctive. Okay, in the sense any one of them works, the proposition will be valid. Now, the precondition support for actions is conjunctive. If an action requires 100 preconditions, that means every one of them must be true before the action can be done. And I can kill an action by just making one precondition not hold. Okay, and so in this particular case, action A1 has 100 preconditions, action A2 has 100 preconditions. One precondition from here and one precondition from here has been marked mutex. And so the actions will be marked mutex. Okay, that's what these rules are saying, in essence. Okay, one other special case, which is kind of a minor special case, is what if I have A7 which requires P and Q as the precondition. In essence, it's mutually exclusive with itself. Okay, so A1, but A7 is like an action A15 which might require, let's say, A and B as the preconditions, and it won't even be put in at this level because there's no A and there's no B. You see that you would only put an action at a level if its preconditions are present in the previous level and they are not mutually exclusive. So previously we only cared about the presence, but now we also throw in the mutual exclusion. Okay? So A7, really, you don't have any point putting this into the graph. Okay? So that's the whole deal about propagating mutual exclusion. Now here's another question. Suppose I'm using mutual exclusions, so I've already done, you know, a certain amount of work in computing the planning graph, and I have some extra time left, so I want to do some mutual exclusion computation. Am I required to do all these rules exactly and make sure that all mutual exclusions are computed? Or is it okay for me to just do some of them, mark some of them, and then stop after that? It turns out that since you're using this whole thing as a heuristic, you can be as lazy as you want. Okay? You can mark some of the mutexes and then say, I have enough. Now I just want to go home now. Okay? And then what's the worst that can happen? Is that for some subsets, you would have a more informed heuristic. For some subsets of goals, where you would have a more informed estimate. For other subsets, you have a less informed estimate. Okay, what would happen to the admissibility? Remember that I'm thinking in terms of level heuristic. If I don't take negative interactions into account, is level heuristic admissible? I mean, one of the reasons why I put this planning stuff right after search stuff is they're sort of reinforcing the ideas that you learned in the search. And, you know, you talked about admissibility and informedness in search heuristics. We are talking about them with respect to a specific problem here. So H level is admissible, okay, because it will never overestimate the cost. Now, if I do H level plus mutex, that means you have a level heuristic on top of a graph which has mutual exclusions marked in, will it still be admissible? Yes. If I don't mark all the mutual exclusions, will it still be admissible? Yes, because what's the worst? You already know that if you don't mark any of them, you are still admissible. So if you mark some of them, you're okay. What if I mark some bogus mutexes? So I'm not only lazy, but I'm also stupid. So I start marking some things which are not mutex as mutexes. So remember, there was a P which has M supports, Q which has N supports, M is 10, N is 5, 50 pairs. You know, you went through them, slogged through like 48 of them. They're all mutex, and I said, forget it. I'll just not check the other two. I'll call them mutex. And it turns out that one of those other two pairs are not mutually exclusive, and so these two are not mutex. Then what happens to the admissibility of your heuristic? It overestimates. Because it essentially says some two things cannot be reached at that level, and yet they could possibly be reached at that level. So as long as you don't mark bogus mutexes, it's okay if you are lazy and mark only some of the real mutexes. Okay? And you will never mark bogus mutexes if you follow these rules. Okay, the only question is, how many times will you follow these rules? You know, how many pairs would you consider? Okay. Let me ask you one more thing. I can't see. There. Okay. This is a summary slide about the admissibility and informedness of the various heuristics. Okay. So H level is always admissible. We agree. Okay, and H in-depth, the H ind is essentially H sum, which adds up the number. That may or may not be admissible. It won't be admissible if, in fact, things are positively interacting. Okay, H level definitely is admissible. Now, what about H relax? I kind of built up H relax. It's a very nice idea. It looks like it can do level idea when the level idea is needed, and some idea where some idea is needed. Now it turns out, unfortunately, that H relax is not admissible. So there is an issue here. So the issue is, if I show you a planning graph, without mutexes, let me take this. So in fact, this is an example. It's a good example. Here is an example where I have shown the planning graph without any mutexes. And I am basically taking the relaxed plan for our example, our, you know, old block told example. So I started with not clear B and hand empty, which are the goals. And the green part of this is the subgraph corresponding to the relaxed plan. That's one of the subgraphs corresponding to the relaxed plan. Now, one of the interesting things is that you notice that for not clear B, there is this guy supporting it, but there is another line supporting it. Why did I pick one of them, not the other? It turns out that if I don't care, since we are ignoring negative interactions, it doesn't really matter which actions you pick. The relaxed plan that you get would be a feasible plan. That means it would have actually executed if there are no negative interactions. But it may not be the shortest such plan. If you're thinking of shortest in terms of the number of actions, it may not be the shortest such plan. Okay? If you want to find the shortest such plan, you have to look for all possible subgraphs of this which can support those two goals. And it turns out to be NP-hard. So, if you want relaxed plan heuristic to be admissible, if you somehow really, really want it to be admissible, then you need to do exponential amount of search looking for the best optimal relaxed plan. Okay? Now, all of them are feasible. Some of them are shorter than the others. And optimal, you're looking for the shortest one. Now, mostly what winds up happening in the planners that use relaxed plan heuristic, what they do is they essentially look for a good relaxed plan by following greedy heuristics. What are the greedy heuristics? Whenever possible, try to support an action. If an action can be supported both by, I'm sorry, a proposition can be supported both by an action and a no-op. You try to do no-op. Why? Because maybe possibly no-op is coming all the way from the initial state. So why do extra work if you can get it free? And furthermore, if you have already picked action A for supporting one of the goals, G1, and G2 has either action A or action B can support G2, you prefer A. Because you already, you know, I got this, you know, this is the usual thing. I already got this red shirt for your brother, and, you know, they are giving two red shirts for a price of one, so I got you also a red shirt. Okay? So it's essentially the same exact action supporting the other one too, when there is a choice. This is just a greedy heuristic. It's not guaranteed to give you the optimal relaxed plan, but it works quite well in practice. Works in the sense that planners that use this relaxed plan to estimate the cost of the goals do quite well. All those great examples that I've shown you last time, they all use this kind of relaxed plan. Okay? Now, what would happen, so H-relax is not admissible unless you find optimal relaxed plan, which is NP-hard. Now, this sort of brings back something that I mentioned in passing a long time back, which is the difference between computer scientists and programmers are that they both will write a program that works. It's just that the computer scientists will feel guilty if they are not following certain rules. Okay, so I have gone through this whole entire notions of admissibility, etc., and I told you H-relax is like the greatest heuristic that everybody is using, and I also told you that it's not admissible anyway. Okay, so if you use H-relax as your heuristic and you come up with a plan, it may or may not be optimal. Okay, and however, that's the one that people wind up using because optimal version. So probably admissible heuristics are very hard to come by. And there are variations. For example, HLEV is a probably admissible heuristic. And there are variations of HLEV with HLEV plus mutex is also a probably admissible heuristic. But they don't seem to compare as well because both of them wind up grossly underestimating in the context of independence. Okay? So there may be an optimal planner which can only solve the first three problems. And then there is a planner with an inadmissible heuristic which is solving, you know, another 100, 200 problems. So there's no competition. If there's no competition, does it matter whether you're optimal or not? You're the only game in town, so people take you. Okay? So that's an interesting point to understand here. Despite the fact that you know that admissibility is a nice property, sometimes you wind up using inadmissible heuristic. Okay. One more thing that I want to point out is here. So this graph is the same as the previous graph except it has these mutual exclusions. Now the question is, what if, so here is an idea, you know, I already told you how to do relaxed plans if you don't have mutual exclusion. Why can't I do relaxed plans when I have mutual exclusion? That's a good idea. That way you would have negative interactions taken in, plus you won't be underestimating the independent goal. So all I need to do is in this graph, find a subgraph which is valid. Now the only difference is previously we said everybody should be supported, and if an action is present, its preconditions are present, and if its preconditions are present, there should be action supporting it in the previous layer. That's still fair. Except now we'll say, well, if you ever pick two actions at a level and they have already been shown to be mutually exclusive, that means they have been marked mutually exclusive, that won't work. You have to change somebody's choice. Okay? That little change, unfortunately, makes finding even a feasible relaxed plan NP-hard. That little change. Previously, optimal relaxed plan is NP-hard. Finding a plan, anybody can do it. Finding a good plan, you can use greedy methods and you can get good money. But the moment you have to, you have this, some guys can't get along well together, you have to start backtracking. So even finding a single feasible plan winds up being hard. And just to show this, let me show you a little animation. Okay. So here is a little planning graph. Okay. And I'm trying to support G1 to G4. I'm trying to support G1 to G4. So I pick the only actions that are available for it, A1, A2, A3, A4. And so their preconditions now come into the next level. Now I started picking, for P1 I picked A5, okay. For P2 I picked A6, fine. For P3 I picked A7. For P4 I picked A8. Now A8 and A6 are marked mutually exclusive. So that last one doesn't work. So then what do? I undo my last choice and I try to say, well, for P4 I'll try A9. Okay? And that seems to be working. So I will, no, it doesn't work unfortunately. There is another mutual exclusion. So now I can't try A9. So they looks like nobody can support P4. Okay, what do I need to do? I need to go up to another level. Okay, so to undo one of the previous decisions. So I'll try to undo P3's decision. This is actually what's called the chronological backtracking idea, where when something goes wrong, you essentially yell at the last thing you did. You are the reason, you know, I just tripped on my, on that stone. Whoever is the last guy you saw, you know, you yell at them. That's chronological backtracking. Intelligent backtracking basically always yells at the right people who caused this failure. In this case, actually P3, poor guy, has not done anything to cause this failure. But you do chronological backtracking, you go to P3, and you try other, no, in this particular case, actually you lucked out. There is nobody else who can support P3. So you lucked out, and so you go above P3 to support, you know, look for a different guy for P2. But you would have been really unlucky if in fact P3 has 15 other guys who can support him. So you would have tried all those guys. For each one of them, you'll come down, you'll get another failure, which has nothing to do with P3. You glare at P3, you go back to P3, you undo P3, and you do a whole bunch of this, and then finally, you'll go out to P2. Chronological backtracking, dumb idea. It's just as dumb as blind search. But it's easy to do. Most people do it first. Okay? So anyway, let's at least understand the chronological backtracking. So you went up to P3, and in this case, there's nobody else for P3, so you go up to P2, you undo the decision for P2. The decision for P2 essentially was supporting P2 with A6. Okay, so what is the other thing I can do? I can support P2 with A11. Okay, and now I come back again down. Now P3, A7, P4, P3, A7, oops, that's not going to work. Okay, do you understand what I'm saying? I do A7 and A11, that doesn't work. Okay, so now I say, that's not good. So now I can't even undo P2. I have to go up and undo P1, but there is nothing else I can undo for P1. So I just found out, if I was a planner, you know, I just found out that I kind of screwed up right here. Essentially, whatever decisions I made spawned some sub-goals which cannot be supported. So I have to go all the way back up to this level and start yelling at the last guy at this level. So A4, glare at him and try to see, G4, glare at him or her and try to see if there is another action that can support it. Now there are many, many things that I'm trying to illustrate with this example. One, finding a feasible sub-plan. That's all I'm trying to do, feasible sub-plan. I couldn't do it. I'm backtracking back and forth. Okay. The second thing, of course, is that in doing this search, you are essentially, the one way of doing it is basically this chronological backtracking, which is sort of a dumb idea. Okay. But you could, so it would be nice to understand how to do the intelligent backtracking. I won't tell you how to. You should learn it yourself. A third thing I want to say is, I came here, I found P1 to P6 cannot be made true here. Should I remember this? Isn't it possible that some other time when I'm searching back, I might wind up needing to make these set of sub-goals true here again, in which case I would have done all this thing in front of you, which would be waste. So I want to remember this. So I put a memo for myself saying, when in this level, never try to make P1 all the way to P6 true because it can't be done. It's called a memo. What is a memo? Memo, I tell you, is nothing but an NRE mutex. Memo is an NRE mutex. All we are saying is that this set of all 6 sub-goals cannot be made true at this level. When P1 and P2 have mutex, all we are saying is P1 and P2 cannot be made true at this level. So MEMO is a higher order mutual exclusion. Earlier I told you that if I can get more mutual exclusions, then I can get the approximation between planning graph and the projection tree closer and closer. I never told you how to get the higher order one. This is one way, which is try to discover them by the hard way, by failing. And when you fail, you get these no goods and you can remember them. And the last point I want to make here is really this, the reason this whole thing failed is not because of all of them, but really because of a subset of them. Okay, and it might be useful to remember which subset of the goal. So remember I said, if you have 2 guys who can't get along, and you put them as part of 15 guys, then the 15 guys still can't get along, because these 2 guys can't get along. Okay, so if you actually, in remembering these memos, if you actually did intelligent backtracking, you would be able to also tell which subset of the goals are the real reason for failure. Okay, and that is actually called an idea called explanation-based learning. Okay, and it's a very useful thing to do, because suppose this morning I woke up, I wore this particular dress, and you know, I had a couple of bottles of whiskey, and I started driving, and I got into an accident. Okay, and I also talked to my wife about various problems, and I yelled at my son, and I got into an accident. Now I'm trying to avoid accidents. I want to explain to myself what has happened. How do I avoid the accident? One simple thing is to avoid doing the exact set of things that I did today. So don't ever wear these jeans, this shirt, don't talk to my wife in the morning, don't have a glass of whiskey, don't yell at my son, and all those things. And if I do avoid all of them, yes, I will avoid the failure. But then, you know, on a different day, I wear different clothes, I'm nicer to my wife, I just did have my whiskey, and I can still get into an accident. By explaining the failure exactly, I can learn and I can avoid the failure much more later on. Okay? And that's essentially what the notion of explanation-based learning and intelligent backtracking are very closely connected. Okay? So those are all the things that are coming out from here. And the last thing to say is this planner called Graph Plan that you talked about, that you read about in the book, all it does is it essentially finds a feasible plan on a planning graph which has mutual exclusions already marked. Now the only tricky part between in saying that is, should Graph Plan mark all mutual exclusions? Remember when I brought up the mutual exclusions, I said, as long as you don't mark up bogus mutexes, it doesn't matter how many you mark. Because not marking any would still be fine, as far as the admissibility of the heuristic is concerned. But if all you are going to do is make this subgraph and give it to somebody saying this is a plan, you can execute it, then you better be sure that there are no negative interactions. It's not enough to close your eyes and assume that the world goes away, okay, which is exactly what we were doing in ignoring the negative interactions using relaxed plan graph. So you need to at least make sure that, so it looks as if you can't just ignore marking mutexes. The question is, should you mark all the mutexes now if you want to do graph plan? It turns out, and again this is an advanced point to make, it turns out that as long as you mark every pair of statically interfering actions, that's the ground truth. If you mark statically interfering actions, and you don't even do any propagation, if you do this kind of a search on that graph, you are guaranteed to get a sound plan. The only advantage you will get for doing additional mutex marking is that you would also be more efficient. So if there's no mutual exclusion propagation, what happens is many of these mutexes that I marked here probably wouldn't have been shown, even though they actually exist. So then they would be found the hard way by failing during the search. Just as we found this as a memo, other mutexes will also be found as memos. As long as you make sure that every pair of interfering actions are marked up. That's all. Okay? Okay, okay. Last point as far as this is concerned. I think I would have said everything else. No, 2 points. Okay, 2 points. Where am I? Okay, there. So I've been talking about planning graph originally for making heuristics. Then the last few minutes about actually making it the basis for doing planning itself. Okay. Now I'll talk about one more use for planning graph. If in fact you are using planning graph to make heuristics, anyway you computed the planning graph and you are about to make heuristics, it turns out that it has other uses. Suppose it turns out that the last level of the planning graph has only actions A1 to A100. And you have grown the planning graph to level up. And the last action level of the planning graph only has actions A1 to A100. I'm doing regression search. Right in front of me is A101, which is saying, I can give you what you want. Should I put A101 into the search and sub-goal on it? You understand what I'm saying? So I construct the planning graph, I reach level up, and in the last level of the level up condition, I only have actions A1 to A100. Okay? Now I'm about to do regression, starting from the goal state, and it turns out that A101, which doesn't exist in the last level, it's part of the domain, and it is giving me the conditions that I want, and it is satisfying the regression requirement. So I'm about to use that to branch as one of the search branches. Does it make sense? No. Because the last level of the planning graph lists all the actions that could ever be potentially applicable in any state that can ever be potentially reached from the initial state. So this is the big bag. If you are not in this big tent, you have no business. You would never be part of any winning plan. If you are in the big tent, you may still not be part of a winning plan. But if you are not in it, no problem. I can throw you out. That's a very useful idea. It turns out that by doing that, you can cut out some of the actions from consideration during the branching. And if you reduce the branching, you improve search. Okay? And there are variations on this which allow you to take more risky gambles. The one that I just told you, it's not at all risky. If there is a solution, you would still find it with this idea. The more risky ones, for example, would say, I will only consider actions that are present in the relaxed plan. Very risky, but seems to work quite fine, especially if you go in the forward direction. And an in-between risky idea is I'll only consider the actions not at the level off level, but the first level where the goals appear. Remember that the goals can appear much before the plan graph levels up. Okay? All of these are to try and cut down branching factor. And then you, once you, whatever branches you have, you can then use this graph to do the estimate. Okay. Remember I had the holy war between progression and regression before? Now the holy war resurfaces, except now we have planning graphs. Okay. Previously I said progression is supposed to be worse than regression, but could be that regression could be worse than progression, because there are reasons to believe either way. Now, when you're thinking of planning graphs, which would be better, progression or regression? It looks as if, in fact, progression should be a dumb idea in the following way. When you're doing progression, what you're doing is you're changing the initial state. So in essence, for every child state that ever comes into the search tree, you would have to generate a planning graph for it. Compute a relaxed plan from that. Add up the number of actions. Throw away this whole work. And then after this is over, then I then say, well, now I have more actions here. Now again, I have to do planning graphs for these. This is what you do in progression. Okay? Well, that's okay as long as your, you know, competitor also is just as bad. Now, unfortunately, what happens for regression is here is the goal state. Initial state remains constant. It's the goal that is, you're coming from goal all the way towards initial state. So how many planning graphs do you ever construct? One planning graph. You would construct as many planning graphs as there are children, leaf nodes, in fact, interior nodes, in the progression. Whereas you construct one for the regression. So if I wake you up and tell you this and say, who do you think will win? You shouldn't be, you would necessarily not be, you know, you shouldn't be yelled at if you say regression, definitely a winning idea. Okay? Unfortunately, it turns out that regression doesn't win. Weird. Okay? The winning planners are progression planners which seem to do these million planning graphs, one for each node, and they still seem to work better overall than regression. Hard to believe, but it's true. Now, why could that be? Well, why could that be is partly because it turns out that, point one, it turns out that when you're going in the forward direction, the planning graph, if they ignore negative interactions and you estimate without negative interactions, you're still much closer to the real value. Because the states that you compute in doing progression, they're all legal states. They're all complete legal states. Okay, that's something that's going for progression search. In regression, on the other hand, remember there was that one search node which was dead and we didn't realize, so we would have made more and more dead nodes and we would have been taking estimates for those. So in particular, if you use planning graphs without negative interaction, then regression would be busily expanding nodes that are dead long back, but it now has children, grandchildren, etc., and they're having a whole entire Lala world among themselves. Okay? So what that means, of course, is for regression, you must take into account interactions, so you should do negative interactions, which means you should propagate mutexes. Point one. That's not too hard. It turns out that even just propagating mutexes is not enough. There could still be higher order interactions. So the speculation is that part of the reason regression planners don't seem to work better than progression planners, although there are compelling reasons why they should work better, is because, in a way, unless you also do higher order propagation, you would still be busy expanding dead nodes. This is a speculation. But still very nice, right? That something that you thought would be right is wrong. So historically, this heuristic was, planning graph heuristic was first used with respect to progression. Then they said, wow, it would be a much better idea with respect to regression. So everybody shifted over to regression. Then somebody actually implemented it and compared, and everybody shifted over to progression. And that's where we are right now. Okay. Now what's more interesting is, as time is going on, people are realizing that you cannot really completely ignore negative interactions even when you're going in the forward direction. There are better and better planners being written which take into account some negative interactions, even in the progression planners, and they seem to be doing that. Okay. So that's, I guess, enough of a messing with your mind as far as progression and regression are concerned. And the very, very last point that I'll make, and I'll really get out of planning, is could I have used planning graph heuristics for partial order planning? You know, I'm only talking about progression and regression till now. Could I have used it for partial order planning? Turns out, yes, you can. Okay, here is an idea. Suppose I have a plan, right? Consider the set of the open conditions of that plan. That is, these are the conditions that don't yet have supporters in the plan. Remember the partial order planning terminology? You know, if you haven't yet worked on some goals, they're open. So you consider just the set of open conditions. Now, act as if these open conditions is the state that you are trying to reach from the initial state. And try to compute what is the first level in the planning graph where all these open conditions are present, and use that as the cost. Now, the question, of course, is I'm doing something bogus because I might require one condition here, one here, one here, one here. So these are open conditions that are required at different points during the execution. They're not all required in the beginning of the plan. However, if I ignore negative interaction, then it turns out that you can get everything that you need in the morning and put it in your backpack, and it will stay with you because you cannot lose anything once you get there. So if you didn't mind me ignoring negative interactions in all this time, you shouldn't mind me ignoring them now either. Right? So I reduce your expectations. Heuristics can be as lazy as they want to be. And I'm ignoring negative interactions, so if I only consider positive interactions, I can act as if the open conditions, which are really conditions that are required to be true at different places, I can act as if they're all made true before and then carried over where they are needed. That's one idea. And it actually works very well. So essentially, when you have two partial plans in the queue, you compute their estimate, distance estimate, in terms of how costly is their open condition list. In terms of how, you know, which is the first level, for example, or which is the relaxed plan that supports these in this planning graph. One other possible idea, which is also very useful, is extending the notion of unsafe links. What was an unsafe link? If you have action A1 giving P to action A2, and there is an action A3 which is giving not P, then there is an unsafe link. And in that case, you know that A3 should either come outside here or outside here. You know this. Now suppose I told you, that, suppose it turns out A3 actually gives Q. It doesn't give P. But it suppose so happens that P and Q are mutex. Now, he said mutex, but remember mutexness could be temporary. I can be mutex for a while and then not be mutex later on. Okay, so the question then is, are there mutexes that will never go away? It turns out that when you are propagating mutexes on the planning graph, you stop when two last layers have not changed in terms of either the propositions or the mutexes. At that point, the set of mutexes left doesn't have to be empty. In particular, it would have things like clear and not clear will continue to be mutex, irrespective of how far you go. Furthermore, in blocks world, if you do mutex propagation, you would find clear B and you would find that clear B and non-AB are mutex. Furthermore, in our example, remember long back we talked about not clear B and holding A. Not clear B and holding A. That was impossible. And you guys, and I think one guy was not asleep and he realized that. Mutexes actually can tell you that. Simple mutex propagation would tell you that in that domain, not clear B and holding A is impossible. So if I have the planning graph with the mutexes already computed, then the mutexes that are in the level of condition, these are called the eternal mutexes, are persistent mutexes, are static mutexes, whatever you want to call them, they'll never go away. Okay? And if P and Q are statically, if they are persistent mutex, then I can act as if A3 is already unhappy, violating this causal link, even though it's not directly saying so right now. Because I can guarantee you that if you are not, if, you know, I can look at A3 and say, yeah, you're acting as if you and I are friends right now, but you will have children and grandchildren who would be my enemies. That's essentially what we are saying. If P and Q are eternally mutex, then that means when you start working on A3's precondition, you're guaranteed that somebody who would come in between would start saying nasty. So you might as well kill it right now. Get it out of the bad, you know, bad region. Right? So these two things, based on planning graph, can be added to partial order planners, and their performance improves significantly. The question, of course, is is their performance as good as progression and regression? Currently, as we speak today, with the heuristics that we currently know of, progression planners win over regression, and regression planners win over false order planning. So, and progression planning took me 3 minutes to explain, regression took me 15 minutes to explain, partial order planning took me 25 minutes to explain. So the losing idea turns out takes longer time to explain right now. But as I said, you know, hopefully you guys will find some ways of making partial order planners work. As I said last time, there are advantages for partial order planners. I mean, there are no significant advantages for partial order planning if all you want to do is make a plan and that's it. But a planner might be interested in not just making a plan and maintaining it while goals change, while new things come, while initial state changes, goals change. In which case you have to kind of keep maintaining this plan by adding new steps and removing unnecessary steps. That sort of analysis is much, much easier with partial order planners than with regression and progression planners, which is part of the reason why NASA guys used a partial order planner in the remote agent experiment. Okay? That's all I'm going to talk about planning. I'm going to switch gears now and ask you, so what we did till now is we talked about problem-solving search and problem-solving agent. And then we said a special class of them is planning of the kind I described till now, which is a factor, which uses a factored representation. What I mean by factored representation is the state has state variables, actions doctor the state variables. And you know, you have to now ask yourself, you shouldn't ask me today, right now, but go home and ask yourself, some of the people said, the guy who said it is not actually here, I don't know the difference between planning and search. Okay, now you should ask yourself, how much of the discussion that we have done in the last couple of classes could have been done without making any assumption about what's inside a state? Okay. Now what I'm going to say is I'm going to think of something at this level still, okay, called, so problem solving agents in essence consider scenarios where I have goals that I want to achieve, okay, and I have an initial state and I need to reach a state where all the goals are true. Nothing matters. All that matters is getting to the goal state. Okay. Now what if you don't have any hard goals? What if I give you, you know, these are 10,000 good things to do, these are 15,000 bad things to do. Do the right thing. That's all I tell you. That's what your parents tell you most of the time. Okay? They didn't say exactly do this. Okay? They essentially, you know that some things like, you know, completing homework on time, good. Seeing movie as soon as it comes out, good too. Which is better? I don't know. You are trying to decide, okay, I'll slack up on the homework this time. I'll get the reward from the movie today. Okay? Are you right or wrong? I don't know. Now, the point is, what if I have a scenario where there are no explicit goals? You get to behave in the world, and based on the states that you go through, you get pats on the back or hits on the head, okay? And your overall performance is, in a sense, the number of pats on the back minus number of hits on the head. In such a case, what does it mean to be a goody two-shoes? That means, what does it mean to be an optimal agent when there is no specific goal state? This ultimately brings back the issue that it's not the goal, it's the journey that counts. People keep saying this, right? So why is it that the journey that counts? It's because the journey also has rewards in itself. Okay? And my question is, if I have that sort of problems, can I do it in any of the search techniques that I have used till now? No, because they sort of assume that there are explicit goals. There is a model called Markov decision processes which should really be seen at the same level as general search. Okay? So in the sense that after I understand it at this level, I can then talk about factored approaches for solving mark gradation processes. Okay? It's a beautiful model, and it's much closer to the kind of problems that happen in the real world for you and me. Okay? You can always ignore rewards for the intermediate states and convert it back into a problem-solving agent. There are enough examples of this too, but it's nice to understand this one too. Now let me give you a very, very simple example of a mark gradation process. I have a grid, okay, and I'm starting from here in the grid. There is a, if I get here, I get a pat on the back. If I get here, I'll get a real big hit on my head, okay, and then for every state that I go to not doing anything, I get a reward. If I just, because I went through that state, I get a reward. The reward could be positive, it could be negative. If I get a negative reward, what would that mean? So I could have, for now I'll assume that my, each state has a reward Ri, which is equal to minus 0.04 for right now. That's what I've decided is the reward. It's like a small, you know, move, essentially. That's what it's telling the agent. You know, you keep hanging around, you would be getting this negative reward. So if you keep going towards where the positive reward is, you'll be that one. Now, these two states have much higher rewards. This one is +1, this is -1. Furthermore, to make it interesting, let me say that they are actually terminal states. That means if I go to either of these states, I cannot do anything more. I would reach here and I'll reach nirvana. Nirvana would be big white light and nothing else happens after that. And I reach here, I'll get big kaboom, big black light, and nothing else happens after that. In between, I'm doing things, okay? And what I'm trying to, of course, do is reach that place, because that's where I'll get much more reward. This is a very special case. I could have other scenarios where I have some small positive values here, some small negative values here, too. Now, I am in this state. I'm an agent. What can I do? All I can do is go up, go down, go left, go right. Now, it turns out that much of this MDP model has nothing to do with uncertainty, but it turns out it is generalizable to uncertainty. And let's talk about an uncertain model because we haven't looked at it before. Okay? So let's act as if when I try to go up, I go up with 0.8 probability, go left with 0.1 probability, go right with 0.1 probability. So if I am here, if I try to go up, with 0.8 probability I will be in this state, with 0.1 probability I will be in this state, with 0.1 probability I would be in the state here, since there is no that state, I will stay here. If there is no state in that direction, then I'll just stay in that state. Yes. That's part of my model. That's a very good point. So how do I know that to stack A on B, I require A being held and B to be clear? Who told me that? Domain model. And if nobody gave me the domain model, then when I'm trying to do this, I will learn as well as plan together. So in particular, if I know these probabilities upfront, then it is essentially a planning problem. If I also don't know these probabilities and I'm improving the estimate of these probabilities, then it is a planning learning problem. Okay? So for example, you might think that you have an incorrect domain model which says when you want to go up, you go up. That's it. So you actually originally assume this is 1.0, 0.0, 0.0. But then after a while of doing this action, you have realized it's not working. And you have changed the probabilities to 0.8, 0.1, 0.1 to reflect what you have actually seen. Now, if you change the domain model this way, then essentially you're doing learning, and in fact, it's called reinforcement learning. Okay, we won't get there right now. Okay. So, in this context, what should I be solving? What is it that I'm trying to solve? So, this is my problem. I told you the problem. What's my solution? So, the problem is I'm here, and if I get there, I'll get a big pat on the back. If I get here, I get a real big hit on the head. If I just dilly-dally do nothing, I'll keep getting some negative reward. So what's the solution? And the solution in essence should be, irrespective of which state you are in, now in this case I'm assuming that the agent knows exactly which state it is in. So at least the world is fully observable. It turns out MDP, as crazy as MDP is, you should not even look at its ugly cousin called partially observable Markov addition processes, where you don't even know which state you are in. Okay? So right now, after you do the action, you open your eyes, you know exactly which state you are in. Okay, that's called fully observable Markov addition process. So the question is, what should the solution look like? Solution should tell you, in each of these states, if I find myself in that state, what must be the action I should do? Remember your father or mother said, do the right thing? What's the right thing? Right thing is, do the right action for each scenario you find yourself in. Good people can find themselves in bad situations. This poor guy is a good guy, he's trying to go like this, but then he may have gone like this. And there may be a guy who's here, who's trying to go up so that they can make a turn and go here for nirvana, but then when he's trying to go up with 1.1 probability, they would go into black holes. Okay? So, when you have action uncertainty, after you do the action, you may still find yourself in a state that you didn't really want to be in. So, given that you are in that state, rather than bitch and moan, do the right thing from that state. Okay, so what is the right thing? That's the question. So the answer for this problem is a policy. It's called a policy. A policy is a mapping of a state to an action. For each state, you say which action should you be doing. This is a policy. Something else is some other policy. The question, of course, is what is the best policy? Best policy could be defined in this context in terms of maximizing the expected reward, which is like increase the number of pats, reduce the number of hits on your head, and go home safely. Okay? So maximizing the expected reward over the time. So if you have a policy like this, and you can start executing this policy. So you, whichever state you are in, you do the action that you're supposed to do. Then open your eyes, see which state you currently are in, do another action that is supposed to be done in that state, until you reach a terminal state. At that point, you have done a behavior. You have followed certain states. You can add up the rewards that you got in all these states. That particular lifetime, that was the total reward you got. You do this multiple times, and you can find out what is the average, or what is your expected reward for the policy. What we are trying to find here is find a policy that has the maximum expected reward. There is a very interesting thing that's going on here. In this place, you notice that when I'm here, I'm not going up. I'm going this way. Why? Because I know that when I try to go up this way, I might go into the negative. So I'm increasing, it turns out that the optimal policy is to go like this and like this. You have done this lots and lots of times. Because you don't take the shortest path. You take the path, many a time on the Grand Canyon, people keep taking shortest paths and find themselves at the bottom very fast. Right? You don't do it all the time. You have to realize that, our steps are not deterministic. When we think that is the shortest path, I can navigate it, I might with some small probability fall down. And those are the guys who write, that the books on Grand Canyon horror book would be stories of them. So in this particular case, based on my particular reward structure, it turns out this is the right thing to do. Now, you should not decide what's best for everybody in the world. You should decide what's best for you, based on your internal reward structure. Now, if you're going this way, that's because your mother and father said, avoid bad neighborhoods. Just avoid them. Okay, so you have a very, very high risk aversion. Okay, now, somebody else might say, here is the original model where the reward for the middle state is -0.04. Okay? Now, if the reward for the middle state is less than -1.684, then the optimal policy would start looking like this. If the reward is in this region for every other every intermediate state, then the optimal policy looks like this. If the reward is in this region, then the optimal policy looks like this. If the reward is here, the optimal policy looks like this. Do you understand why? Consider this guy. This guy is saying, just hanging around is lots of fun by itself. Why be done with life? Okay, so what this guy is doing is avoid getting anywhere to the terminal state. Okay, whenever I'm at the terminal state, I go to the opposite direction. In other places, I can be doing anything. Just avoid death. My kind of a guy. Okay, this guy on the other hand is your classic depressed guy. He says, end it all right now. I can't stand it anymore. We should right now. Okay, end it all. Okay, all I did was this guy, all these guys, with respect to his or her reward structure, this is the optimal policy. With respect to this guy's reward structure, this is the optimal policy. With respect to this guy's reward structure, this one, and so on. So what we are going to spend time when we come back next is figure out how to compute these optimal policies. And it turns out that, the last point I'll make, and I always say this, this is the optimal policy for this particular original problem, and it turns out that you can actually talk about, for each state here, you can talk about something called the maximum, something called the value function, which is, if you are in this state, what is the maximum amount of expected reward you can get? If you start from this state and do various things, okay, and then reach terminal state, and then compute the reward there, and then start again from this state, and compute the reward again until you end. And then if you take the, so in fact, the more important thing is, when you start from here and do the optimal thing, starting from this state, what is the maximum expected reward you can get, cumulative reward you can get from that state? Now it turns out that the best way to compute this policy is to compute this value function. And just so that you have something you will understand, if this action was deterministic action, if this action were to be deterministic action, okay, this value function would essentially be shortest distance from that state to the terminal state. Okay? This, on the other hand, so value function really can be thought of as a generalization of H star, which is the perfect heuristic function. Just as H star is also given for every state. It's the shortest goal from that state. Distance of the shortest goal from that state. Now, U star is the maximum expected reward you can get from that state. And we'll see how to compute these optimal policies, one of which would be to compute this first and then compute this. The other is to just keep changing policies until it stabilizes at the optimal policy. We'll talk about both of them next.